Hello. What a week. What a week. Welcome to So Let It Be Written. It's been crazy. I've been consumed by this subject for a long time. My guest today, November 22nd, is Larry Hancock. Larry Hancock, Larry is an expert on the JFK assassination. He's one of many. What a lot of people don't realize, there is this whole community of people. They call themselves the JFK Research Community. A whole network of people that are heavily steeped in, invested in, interested in, absorbed by, consumed by, in some cases, what really happened with the JFK assassination, which now took place. I should have memorized this by now. Which now took place. 57 years ago today, November 22nd, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. As most people know, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. The official story originally for that lasted for many years was that he was killed by a lone nut communist Marxist named Lee Harvey Oswald, who shot him with a high-powered rifle from the sixth floor of the Book Depository building in Dallas, middle of the day on a Friday. It was really an event that changed the world and changed America, at least. I wasn't alive for it. My mother was. My mother was in high school. She vividly remembers getting the news while she was in school about it. It's one of those events like 9/11, where anyone who was alive then could tell you where they were when they found out what happened. So my guest today is Larry Hancock. He is the author. He's a contributor to a website called maryferrell.org. He's the author of Tipping Point, The Conspiracy That Murdered President John F. Kennedy. He writes numerous articles. He's up to date on a lot of things that happened. And he's been doing this investigation for about 30 years. And he talks on the podcast quite a bit about what he thinks happened on November 22nd, what he believes is the case. And we get into quite a lengthy conversation about why the cover-up and why was he killed and who was involved and can he name some names. And of course he did, and it was a really fascinating conversation. I've been really interested in this subject for a number of years, probably ever since I saw JFK, the movie, the Oliver Stone film in 1991, when I was just in high school myself. I think I saw it a couple of years after, so I was actually in college, I think, when I saw JFK. I didn't see it in the theaters or anything. I'm not even nearly as well-versed about the conspiracy theories that are out there and the ones that particularly are have some legitimacy to them, the way that Larry Hancock is. I got so interested in this podcast that I actually ended up talking to two people. So you're going to hear, this is part one of really a two-part podcast on the JFK assassination. Tomorrow I'm going to release a conversation with another researcher and historian by the name of Jim DiEugenio. But for right now, if you're interested in this kind of thing, stay tuned and listen to my conversation with the writer, historian, researcher, all around good guy, Larry Hancock. Tell you how excited I am about this, because I go through these spurts where I'm like consumed by this whole subject, it's exciting to finally talk to somebody who really has been really digging deep. You mentioned you've done 30 years of investigation work on this.
Yeah, so my spurt's a little bit longer.
Yeah, sure. You are, so I, you're Larry Hancock. You're a contributor to MaryFerrell.org, or some of your work appears on MaryFerrell.org.
Yeah, I'm a board member of the Mary Farrell Foundation, but also I've done interviews that appear on the website. I've published individual pieces. For example, I published an almost book-length piece on the RFK assassination that was serialized on the site. Currently, I'm serializing my newest book, Tipping Point, on the site. So yeah, I publish quite a bit on Mary Farrell, but of course, I've had several books that have been published standalone.
So who is Mary Farrell, if I can ask? Her name comes up a lot when I've been researching somebody to talk to me.
Sure. Mary was one of the original, I would say, first generation Dallas researchers, if you would. She had been a secretary in a law office in Dallas, but like many locals in Dallas, just became very curious about the assassination, the official assassination story. Basically, the general term for these folks were called critics or skeptics because they were all skeptical about what came out in the Warren Commission report. Mm-hmm. And that really launched Mary into years and decades of collecting documents, looking at documents. Basically, all of these folks were really examining what was presented and testing what was presented in the Warren Commission report. But she amassed a huge collection of documents. Back in those days, the way you got documents, the only way you got documents was either go directly to the National Archives or do mail request and get things directly. Nothing was online. So she amassed a huge physical collection of documents, which eventually became digitized and incorporated online. It's part of the content of the Mary Farrell Foundation, which is now well over 1.5 million pages of documents.
Now, are you guys a community, would you say? Like, invest, what would you call yourself? Skeptic community or JFK research?
Are you? I would say JFK research community. I mean, it's very broad.
Is it a friendly one, or are you guys at each other's throats?
I would say at times it's friendly, at times it's at the basis, okay, in terms of everybody going out and looking for information, it's friendly. I mean, there are a bunch of people that pursue documents, share documents, that do oral history, share, you know, all of the sharing part is very friendly and very open. Okay. But then again, bottom line is most people end up with their own theory, their own hypothesis, whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency to kind of like champion it. So there are a lot of debates. And yeah, so there's a contentious part of it as well. Kind of like I found this and this proves that. And somebody else goes, well, I found this and that proves something else.
Oh, that's interesting. And so then tell us about Tipping Point. What do you think happened on November 22nd?
Oh, Tipping Point really is the culmination, basically, of all those 30 years. And by the way, I don't know if it's since it's being serialized on Mary Farrell for, it'll be a book, but it's also being serialized just for public viewing by anybody. Mm-hmm. It'll be easy for anyone to take a look at. Basically, to boil it down, it would be one of the solutions that is under the general category of CIA officers and assets that were working for CIA officers were involved in the assassination and directly involved in the attack in Dallas. So it's kind of within the CIA genre.
Okay. So then your theory kind of aligns a little bit with the Garrison investigation. Like, what do you make of the Garrison investigation?
The Garrison investigation, and actually Tipping Point does talk a lot about New Orleans. It talks about some of the people that Garrison identified and thought were suspicious. It talks about Lee Oswald's activities in New Orleans, which Garrison thought were very suspicious. Right. I think Garrison served everybody a real Garrison was a real eye-opener in terms of developing the point that Lee Oswald was not a lone nut. Lee Oswald was connected to a lot of people. Lee Oswald was doing a lot of things. And the Warren Commission kind of tried to portray him as this lone nut guy who didn't know anybody, nobody knew him, and he just kind of came out of left field and shot the president. Garrison's investigation made it very clear that was not true at all. There were lots of people in and around Oswald, and Oswald was definitely not a loner per se. And that's probably the biggest Garrison did other things. Garrison was the one to surface the Zapruder film. The public had never seen that before. It had been withheld from the public. And that was explosive due to the fact that basically anybody that looks at that film for the first time and sees JFK blown back into the seat will intuitively see a shot from the front. I mean, it's clear that's why that was withheld for so long, because to explain that away, you have to leap through hoops that, you know, people start raising their eyes and going, you're trying to, you know, I can see what happened. What are you doing?
Right. That's what I was wondering, because, you know, the one thing I haven't really looked into that much is, or really didn't come across, was Governor Connally's testimony to the whole thing. Governor Connally was in the front. Connally was in the front seat. He got hit in the wrist. You know, most people are aware of like the magic bullet theory and all that. Did he ever say, like, go on record as saying that, like, the bullet came from the front? Or where was his account? His account is consistent with the Warren reports?
It's interesting. He really didn't take a firm position. He kind of, I wouldn't call it obfuscation. Basically, if you look at his testimony, his remarks about what he thought was happening at the time of the shooting are definitely in line with the fact that he thought there were multiple shooters. In fact, he talks about a volley of fire coming into the car. So there's no doubt that he thought there were multiple shooters at the time. Mm-hmm. After the fact, I think one of the telling points is that he would never allow the fragments and the materials from his wound to be released for examination. Mm. So basically, he just stepped back from the whole issue. I would say it probably is the best description.
You think he was just scared?
I think a lot of those folks, I don't know that he was personally scared of anything happening to him, but there were just a lot of people that stepped away from talking about, even some of the Kennedy aides. You know, we have on record that many of the current Kennedy aides, at least two of them that were in the motorcade, are on record of saying, oh yeah, there was shooting coming in from all over the place. We knew that, but we felt that would just make more trouble for the Kennedy family. They, you know, everybody wanted to shut this down and make it as, it was already painful enough. So why expand on that? And so they didn't talk about things like that, or chose not to.
This is the president of the United States. Jeez.
I know, but you do, I mean, it's not that privately they didn't talk. RFK immediately thought there was a conspiracy. RFK's first two calls that afternoon were to the CIA director talking about whether or not the CIA had done it. And the second call was to his friend among the Cuban exiles, essentially telling him, I know your people did it. Mm-hmm. So it's not like Jackie Kennedy is on record of written a letter saying she knew there was more than one shooter. So it's not like they didn't know it, but talking about it in public was something different in 1963.
So when you, I believe I read correctly, you were a teenager when this happened?
Yeah, I was a sophomore in high school when this happened.
And then the Garrison investigation was about 3 years later, right? 66?
Yes, and it's kind of funny. I can remember, to show how little everybody knew about what was going on, really, I can remember the Garrison investigation coming up and hearing about it on the news. And everybody just turned to each other and went, this guy is in New Orleans. What does anything have to do? What does that possibly have to do with Kennedy being shot in Dallas? And we didn't even understand anything about Lee Oswald, you know, and his background and those connections. So I think it got a lot less attention than it might have, just because it was, it just like, where'd that come from? You know, we don't understand.
Ah, so that didn't wake you up? Like, that wasn't the...
No.
Yeah, okay.
No, not at all. I didn't really wake up to this until in the early 90s. And probably the first thing that got my attention was when my wife mentioned to me that I always had some interest because it happened at a, you know, critical period in my life, but she mentioned to me that there was a book coming out by a Dallas reporter on the Kennedy assassination. And that was Jim Marr's book, Crossfire. And I got that, read that, and as I told Jim many times personally later, I blamed him for, like, you know, tying up the next 25 years of my life. He seemed to have no problem with that at all, though.
Yeah, I can imagine. So then who was Clay Shaw? Because that was one that came up in the Garrison investigation, came up in the JFK movie. That was my entrance into this old JFK. I was much, you know, I was born after Kennedy was already dead, but my real interest in the case was sparked by that film, by the Oliver Stone film. And I knew right away that there were some issues with the film and he took some creative licenses, but I did look into Clay Shaw a little bit and just see who was, like, has he been sort of dismissed by you, or what's the community think about him? Because he has
I think he certainly hasn't been dismissed. I think the confusing factor, and this is where one of Garrison's problems was, he kept running across people that were associated with Oswald in some fashion, but it was unclear, you know, what they wrote. There were just so many ways that different people were associated with Oswald. But what he found out about Clay Shaw that made Shaw stand out is that Clay Shaw did indeed have some sort of connection to the CIA, mm-hmm. which fell within, I mean, we know that Garrison's very first interest and the first thing he investigated was were a number of mysterious Cubans that were known, or Cuban expats, whatever, who were in, associated with Oswald, and he tried to track that down in New Orleans, from New Orleans to Miami, actually. And his old investigation got blown to the public through some of the contacts he made in Miami, primarily a fellow named Bernardo de Torres. But back to your question about Shaw, so there was a point when he was interested in two things: who was around Oswald, and did they have any connection either to Cubans or to the CIA, which put him into really dangerous trouble because he was cutting into national security areas. There's no doubt about it. They used to be in the Cuba Project, CIA's assassination plots against Castro. So he was treading on a lot of toes. Now, as to Clay Shaw, basically the CIA's first response in all of those things was to deny everything. The CIA always denies being associated with anybody. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they denied an association with Shaw. We know now that Shaw had been a source for the CIA, a source within the international community, a source at the trademark. He'd collected information by the CIA. Not anything terribly unusual. I mean, there were hundreds of businessmen that did the same thing during that period of time. But the fact that the CIA lied about it made it especially suspicious. So one of the problems Garrison had is, okay, you can tell people are lying and it's suspicious. Does that lead you to the conspiracy? Okay. And that took him off on a couple of different tangents, not just Shaw, but Ferry and some other people. I would say what we do know is certainly we've learned that Shaw did use an alias and lied about it. He did serve as an asset for the CIA and lied about it. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, we absolutely know Garrison was on the right trail of some of those things. Whether that leads to Dallas and the assassination is another story entirely. I mean, if you took all the tangents where Oswald crossed paths with CIA asset sources or officers. You got many, many tangents that you could pursue.
Yeah, that's what it seems to be like. Oswald does seem like one of the hubs where from which there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of spokes, you know, the hub of the wheel, and there's a lot of spokes that can branch off from him.
And it doesn't necessarily take you to the same place. And it's very difficult determining, you know, which are literally tangents and which might connect to Dallas. You know, that's the real challenge.
Right. Yeah, I would think it, because, I mean, there are theories out there that Oswald wasn't even in the book depository, but some people where do you stand on that?
Oh, I think Oswald was definitely in the book depository. I tend to be of the opinion that Oswald definitely was not part of the assassination. He wasn't part of the plot. He was manipulated. He was used. He was set up as a pointer to Castro and Cuban involvement with the assassination. But Oswald himself was being used and manipulated, not just Oswald, but Oswald's identity. It's now very clear. And one of the things I cover in Tipping Point is that Oswald's identity and basically the image that he built up in New Orleans that summer as a, you know, a Marxist, socialist, communist, Castro supporter was of use to the CIA in a great many ways for propaganda purposes, for counterintelligence purposes. So again, you're left with the fact that Oswald is many things to many people, including many things to the CIA. But as far as the shooting itself, no, I don't think Oswald was involved in that at all.
He said he was a patsy, no?
He said he was a patsy. No. Now, actually, the context, as with a lot of things, the context of that is pretty important. He said he was a patsy, and the fact that he had, in terms that he'd been to Russia and been arrested. And Oswald certainly, you know, with his mindset, it's sort of like, okay, if anything bad happens, you know, the FBI, the law enforcement is going to pick up, you know, what's the thing about the usual suspects? What's your usual suspect? Okay, somebody killed the president. It had to be the commies. Okay, who around here? Oh, well, Lee Oswald. So he did make it clear that that's his past associations made him a patsy. Whether he knew anything more specific than that, you know, can be argued, but certainly in that regard, he was right about that. There's no doubt that his image made him a perfect patsy.
At this point, it's not as common, but there's still, I think, a healthy amount of people out. I remember watching a couple of years ago, well, I guess it's got to be close to 10 years ago now, that watching the Bill Maher show one time, and he brought up the Kennedy assassination. It might have been around the anniversary of his death or whatever, like around now. But, you know, when he said that, you know, if they're all said and done, everything's been weighed, I really just think Oswald acted alone. And there are some pockets of people out there who just think this is really a simplistic story. Why do you think that is? Do you think that people are just, there's too much imagination and the answer is always simpler? Or
I think the problem is people really, a number of people, lots of people really prefer a simple answer. I mean, you know, we all, it's kind of like, oh, I understand that. And a lot of people really don't want to engage in it. You can't really see how it was not simple unless you're willing to invest some serious time in it. As with many crimes. I mean, let's face it. If you really get into crimes and prosecutions, et cetera, one of the things that you quickly see is if a prosecutor has a single obvious person to take into court, cases are made and won against a simple line of prosecution. You know, conspiracy is never good for prosecutors because it starts introducing too many variables and, you know, too many traits. You confuse the jury. So it just is almost any other crime. If you've got somebody that gives you a simple story, and in this case, of course, somebody with no motive at all that could ever be offered, it's still kind of simpler just to sit back and go, okay, well, at least I, of all the things I don't know about the world, this one seems simple, right? and not go any further, because to really engage with this subject, you have to first understand why the official story has holes in it, and that takes some work, mm-hmm. and then engage with the second point, which is really, why would the officials, you know, why wasn't it simple? Why wasn't, if it was more than one person, why didn't they find that right off? That's the real, they're really two separate things that you have to deal with before you even get into a conspiracy. And that's a lot of work. It really is.
Yeah, and I guess there's also disbelief that investigations or law enforcement could be that incompetent, that they wouldn't be able to unearth it quicker.
And I think that's true. And that takes you into the fact of what's the test for that premise. Let's just say that I said that, kind of like, okay, well, obviously law enforcement investigated it. They collected evidence, and we assume that they did a thorough job. The evidence is good. But in a legal sense, how does that happen in the real world? How do you really prove that? You prove it in a trial. You mm-hmm. prove it with a defense attorney challenging all that evidence, questioning all the evidence, bringing in counter evidence. And of course, there was no trial. So none of that body of evidence ever got legally tested. And that's what this research community that you ask about mm-hmm. started doing. So if you take it for an act of faith that the investigation was comprehensive and all good, it is an act of faith because that was never tested.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, they were never able to actually prove it out, air it out, and prove it all in any open court.
And even in a pro bono sense, the Warren Commission could have done something of that nature. Mm-hmm. And Mark Lane volunteered to, in a pro bono role for the Warren Commission, to play that legal role, to test, offer a counter story. And basically they said fine and never let him do it. So the Warren Commission report itself was never tested internally. And now the problem is, at the time, nobody knew that. Nobody knew that several of the commissioners actually dissented from portions of the Warren Commission report. We couldn't see the internal transcripts. That one of the fascinating internal transcripts shows us, A, they had no investigators of their own, really. They were totally dependent on the FBI. And in one session, they're talking about the fact that, well, we know Hoover will tell us what he wants to tell us, and we have no idea of knowing if it's right or wrong. And you know, people couldn't see the inside of the Warren Commission itself. And it's actually frightening to see some of the transcripts at points where they actually have this internal conversation and somebody goes, oh no, stop the transcript. We can't discuss this and have it go on the record. Mm. Now, after you've seen that once or twice, how much faith do you have in their work?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I would think is just the very fact alone that, and I want to ask you about the document releases and whatnot, but the very fact alone that we are getting the information, documents are being released in drips and drabs over the course of, I guess, now 5 decades, wouldn't that almost be evidence in and of itself that there was something more to this than just one lone crazy person in a book depository?
The fact that they were so selective. I mean, they published volumes and volumes of documents and materials as an attachment to the report, mm-hmm. yet left out some of the most critical things. The fact that they were so selective with what they published, as you say, is a very good, it's kind of like, why'd you guys leave that out? You obviously left out some very important stuff. So what you can conclude then is they were making a case. I think, and your point is taken, and the fact, why would you leave all that stuff out if this was a balanced decision? Now, wouldn't you have some pros and cons? Wouldn't you have this way, and we had to make a decision. All of that is obfuscated.
A
particular example of that is rather striking. They convened a ballistics team to examine the bullets in the film, and the key, the bullet that supposedly went through both JFK and Connolly, mm-hmm. and they ballistics team did a lot of tests. These are all experts who have seen thousands and thousands of wounds. At the end, the ballistics team offered a formal report that said, no, can't have happened that way. This bullet didn't do that. There's no circumstances under which this bullet could do what you want it to. There was only one dissenting observation on among the group, and that was the Warren Commission liaison to the group.
What's
and name? Of course, that Specter.
Who?
Later a senator.
Oh, Specter. Senator Specter, okay.
And so that was among those things not included. Yeah, it's just, you reach the point of clearly there was a mission that they were following. Now, I'm not saying they were all, but there was a charter to make the case against Oswald, just as only later, years later, did we recover the report that was written Sunday afternoon within the FBI, with Hoover directing the FBI to write a report stating that Lee Oswald was the lone shooter and acknowledging that it was going to be very difficult to do that based on the evidence in hand. That was 2 days after the shooting. You know, once you read that report, how can you possibly think that this was an open-ended criminal investigation?
Right. Yeah, it's like it seems like they made their conclusion and then just tried to make the evidence that fit and threw out or obfuscated the evidence that wasn't going to fit that in one narrative.
And it took them about 24, 48 hours to get to that position. I mean, in the very beginning, Hoover had ordered a very open-ended, like, go out and question everybody. Mm-hmm. And he totally rescinded that order within 18 hours. Before Saturday and noon, he issued a new order saying, we're only interested in either leads that point to Oswald. That's all. We've got him. We're making a case against him. That's it. Don't waste your time on anything else.
So is this where you kind of come in and think that there was a sort of the intelligence community got, you know, were the ones kind of pulling the strings on that? Was Hoover pressured maybe by the intelligence community? Hoover getting bullied into doing anything, but
I don't think he was pressured by the intelligence community per se. My opinion would be that within the first 48 hours, it became apparent that there was more to it than Lee Oswald. For example, you have a conversation between Hoover and Johnson talking about Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City and there being more people involved. We know that part of the tape of that conversation was later erased, and that's been acknowledged. Basically, what happened, I think, during the first, again, day and a half, is it became pretty clear at the highest levels, National Security Council level, that there was a conspiracy, and it either pointed towards the Cubans and Russians, the Cubans, or possibly rogue actors within the CIA. And nobody really wanted to go there. Basically, a decision was made that this is something that we don't, you know, this could tear, A, it could get us into a war. B, it could tear apart the intelligence community. We can't afford this from a national security perspective. So what it looks like is that nobody pulled any strings per se. The decision was literally made that we can't engage with it. It's too costly. We will find out something that we'll have to act on, and we don't want to do that. So it's more we don't want to know. We need to put this to bed really quick. We have something very similar on a smaller scale. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, we know the Attorney General and Hoover issued a statement within hours that only one individual was involved and there was no conspiracy. And later, the Attorney General said they didn't know that. This was simply a damage control effort to stop riots, to try to control. This is a standard situation. This is basically this. I wrote another book called Surprise Attack, mm-hmm. which is a study of the national security response during any crisis of this sort. And the first reaction is always to gain control. Mm-hmm. And the way you gain control is to minimize matters, not to maximize them. You try to focus it and tie it down while you're getting a handle on things. And then you get to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And I think the decision they made was just not to go there.
Wow. So you think something similar might have happened with MLK, you mean? That there might, that was, there were more people involved in his?
Oh, we know what happened with MLK. Oh, yeah. Wow. The Attorney General, oh, absolutely. They made a decision that certainly they had, again, how can you have King shot and say within 4 hours that you know no more than one person was involved when there were clans and groups? And it's just an insane statement on the face of it. But that's the sort of thing that happens.
Are we thinking that maybe it was rogue elements of the CIA? What was the motivation to kill him then? Like, why did the CIA, I'm assuming it had to do with Castro?
That really is the bulk of that's the bulk of what I write about in, I wouldn't suggest that it was the CIA as an organization. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that there were certain individuals in the CIA who took it upon themselves for two reasons. First of all, there was real concern that Kennedy was not being aggressive enough. For example, he'd taken a position of neutrality in Laos. There was a possibility he might take a position of neutrality in Vietnam and move for a settlement in Vietnam. That worried some very senior people. But what the tipping point really was that when it was discovered that he was privately in back channel negotiations with Fidel Castro to reach an accommodation over Cuba. And that was kind of the last straw for the CIA officers who had been engaged for 3 years trying to kill Castro, overthrow Castro, lost friends in action for their Cuban exile compatriots who had lost friends. That, you know, that was an act of treason. I mean, that was their view. A, that Kennedy was treasonous, and B, that if they didn't do something immediately, you know, there's going to be an accord. There was the first meeting between a Kennedy representative and a Castro representative to set up direct negotiations was scheduled to happen in late November.
Right.
And Kennedy was very enthusiastic about it and needed it. I mean, if you look at what was going on with Kennedy, he needed to resolve Cuba. He needed to resolve Vietnam before the next election. Mm-hmm. Both of them were huge, you know, problems for him politically. But if he could have gotten Castro to kick the Russians out, go neutral, I mean, it would have been a huge political win for him. Mm-hmm. But for the Cuban exiles, they were never going home again.
Right. Okay. So it Kennedy was killed for being a little too soft or for negotiating with communism.
Yeah, he was the only president we had had up to that time who could understand nationalism, who could understand anti-colonialism. He didn't think that neutrality was evil. I mean, Truman, Eisenhower, later, you know, Nixon, Reagan. Neutral is bad. You can't be neutral. You're either on our side or you're on the Russian side. Kennedy understood that neutrality was an option, and that was dangerous to a lot of people.
What is there anything significant about it happening in Dallas? Because I read I read a book called Dallas 1963, I think was the title of the book, and it really talks about it. You know, it ends with the shots being fired, so it's everything leading up to November 22nd, and it covers. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it talks about the sort of political climate and the cultural zeitgeist that was in Dallas at the time. And there were even some advisors apparently telling Kennedy he should cancel his Dallas trip. I forget the name escapes me now, had just been assaulted a couple of days prior. I can't remember his name now, but I want to say Spiro Agnew, but it wasn't. Somebody hit with a sign by a woman.
The UN ambassador had been hit with a sign, a protester. Yes. Three or four answers to that question. Dallas was considered politically dangerous in terms of demonstrations and protest and that sort of thing. You know, it was considered politically dangerous. The great fear in Dallas was there would be public protest, there would be mobs, and basically all of the security, there was a lot of security being put in place, but it was to protect Kennedy, like at the Trade Center, where he was going to make a speech. That's where most of the security was. There were large crowds protesting there. People were arrested. Nobody was thinking that much about the motorcade, other than it maybe being blocked. But there were concerns about protests. But in terms of what, there were about three things that, timing-wise, Dallas was important. In my view, because it was in October, that this Cuba thing became visible to the people that actually put together the plot. Mm-hmm. So there were really only a couple of places that he was going aside from Washington, D.C. One would have been in Florida, the others in Dallas. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to put together an attack, you know, Dallas is, you know, he's going to Texas. These people already had links into Dallas. Several of them had been traveling to Dallas because there was money supporting Cuban exiles coming out of Dallas. There were some covers to move people back and forth to Dallas. Mm-hmm. But probably most important, the two most important things for something like that is you needed someone local that could tell you about what the police practices were going to be, that could tell you about the security that was going to go into place, that could tell you about the motorcade route. Basically, you needed some field intelligence. And the key person that was available that these people had already known and already worked with was Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby provided them something unique in terms of access to information and local logistics. The other thing, of course, that by October, the other factor that made Dallas key was that's where Oswald was. Mm-hmm. And Oswald had a new baby and Oswald wasn't going to be leaving. So Oswald was, it certainly wasn't unique, but it's kind of like if you found yourself deciding to plan an attack, mm-hmm. say in the beginning of October, and you've got like 5-6 weeks to put it together, and where do you put it? You put it in Dallas. But there's not anything per se about Dallas. You know, actually the crowds turned out to be friendly, so it's not Dallas is a, if you want to put it, Dallas is a workable killing field in tactical terms for paramilitary professionals. It works.
It wasn't just because the book I read talked about, you know, that the influence of H.L. Hunt, who was a real right-wing, staunch conservative, you know, powerful businessman in Dallas, and General Walker, who had been fired, I think, by the Kennedy administration. Somebody took a shot at him, you know, in the right leading up to the assassination. So there's some ideas that maybe Dallas was, you know, just this perfect spot because there was the powers that be were so, you know, there was such a, how would you say it, abrasive towards a Kennedy visit, but then the Ruby thing, then this spins off the theory into mob connections or mafia connections. No.
Let's say mob connections. What it really spins off is the fact that Ruby himself had been very much involved years earlier in Cuban dealings. He was used as a courier to take money in to get out Traficante, who had been imprisoned. Ruby knew some of the guys, some of his close friends who from Dallas who had gone to work in the Havana casinos. McWillie, some other people, they were good friends. He traveled and he was ideal as a courier because he really didn't have any high level mob or mafia connections. He was just somebody they knew that was useful and he wanted to play that game. But interestingly enough, one of the things that he did as part of that deal was to organize a big shipment of trucks and other vehicles going to the Cuban government out of New Orleans. And so Ruby connects the dots both into, most people don't know that Ruby was actually a source for the FBI during this period of time when he was involved in Cuban affairs. And he very likely was one of the individuals who turned in some of the gun runners that were running guns to the Castro Revolution. Interestingly enough, one of the people he was connected to and may have turned in was a fellow named Robert McCowan from Houston, Texas, who was very close to Fidel Castro. Castro actually came to visit him on his trip to the UN after the revolution. McCowan was very much identified with Castro, but he had also been identified with Jack Ruby. And later on, only weeks before the assassination, McCowan would be visited by Lee Oswald.
Oh, yeah, that's a name I have not heard. McCowan, you said?
Yep, Robert McCowan. You'll definitely see him in Tipping Point. Yeah, he doesn't get nearly as much discussion as he should because nobody pays as much. Jack Ruby got a lot of attention in JFK assassination lore in the early days. He just doesn't get a lot of the investigative work on him has kind of fallen by the wayside because that's old news.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you have to go back and pull this stuff together. We're pretty sure we know actually who took Oswald to visit him, who was actually part of the attack in Dallas.
Oh, wow. And that's McCowan.
Visited McCowan. Actually, the reason they visited McCowan is they were trying to get McCowan to sell weapons to Oswald. I mean, he had been a gun runner to Castro. Can't you just imagine what would have happened if a weapon that was traceable to a Castro gun runner had been found in the school book depository?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's interesting though. There was a trial for Jack Ruby, and yet nothing surfaced deeper than what? Than did he had said he had claimed that he had done it because he loved the Kennedy family or something. He felt bad for his children.
his first defense, his first attorney, said that he had done it because he was really in love with the Kennedys, which was hard to prove since apparently officially, he didn't even go out and watch the motorcade. So how much could he have been in love with them? But he didn't want Jackie to come back to Dallas for a trial. I mean, that was the first motive offered for Ruby's killing Oswald. In later years, that attorney admitted that he had made that up out of whole cloth. He made it up. Jack never said that. He made it up because he couldn't find, like, there was no motive. We need a motive if we're going to go to court and try to get you out of this, Jack. Melvin Belli came in to defend Ruby, of course, he relied strictly on an insanity defense, a form of insanity. And so, again, basically, it's one of those trials, as with the trial of Sirhan Sirhan or the trial in the MLK case where the defense attorney accepts all the evidence. That's like, okay, we're just going to plead something else, diminished capacity. We're going to plead guilty. We're going to whatever, but we're not going to challenge any of your evidence. So they didn't, the prosecution didn't need to bring any evidence. What do you need? You've got Ruby on film shooting Oswald. What else do you have to introduce? There's just no room.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't realize. It's funny. I don't know if you can see me on camera or not, but I have these are all old. I found my mother's got all these newspapers from back
when. Oh, yeah. Those look familiar.
The Daily News. This is the Daily News from November 25th, 1963. And just before we got on the phone, I started to read the article about Ruby. And, you know, one of the things he said to his sister was, I couldn't help it. And then he said, don't worry about me. And I remember, you know, I just recently read a book about this saying that, you know, he was maybe just used just as much as Oswald was used and maybe thought he was going to kind of walk away or do a minimal time because of some of the laws on the books in the state of Texas about shooting people out of an act of passion. So I don't know if there's any truth to that, but I just thought that was interesting that he seemed like, oh, don't worry about me. I'm going to be fine. That you could read into that is my point.
Yeah. I think what he meant was about going to be fine. And this, you kind of have to turn it around a little bit. If you really kind of do a micro analysis of Ruby's behavior, starting about 2 weeks before the assassination until he shoots Lee Oswald, it becomes clear that Ruby was involved in something, but he wasn't worried about it. And he did make quite a bit of money. That's a proven fact. He suddenly came into a lot of money beforehand.
Yeah.
And I think you can make a case that he was hired to do a minor support role, provide information, very low level and made some money. And there's no fear in that. As a matter of fact, he told a fellow who turned out to be an IRS informant, asked him to come watch the motorcade with him. Because, you know, there might be some fireworks. Ruby, but that didn't, he wasn't nervous. I think he might have realized something was going to happen, but not what did happen. And if you look at his own physical condition that afternoon, he goes from, he's supposedly at the newspaper office, hears about the shooting, and as soon as he hears about the shooting, he goes white. And then within an hour, he's at his sister's throwing up. I mean, clearly something happened that he totally didn't expect. But in regard to what you just read, it was quickly made clear to him that either he do what he was then told to do, which was kill Oswald. And that was based on a phone call he made to Los Angeles about 45 minutes after the assassination. The only phone call he made that afternoon other than to his sister, that he was going to be okay if he did what he was told to do.
Right.
If he didn't do what he was told to do, then he's done. He's expendable. So he's got a path not going to jail, but to not getting killed. And not just him getting killed, but the way these things normally work is it's he and his family. And he later made remarks that he was happy that his sister was going to be okay. But we have to accept the fact that he also told Earl Warren that there was no way he could tell him the truth in Dallas unless they gave him back, took him back to Washington, D.C. and gave him protection, and Warren chose not to do so. So, you know.
Yeah. The documents that are getting released, it seems like it's drips and drabs. Now, from what I understand, there was a new big document dump back in what, 2012? Was it?
The real serious document dumps, as it were, started in the late 90s after the JFK Records Release Act that came off of the Oliver Stone movie. That really started releasing thousands of pages of documents a year. Then the next step in that was the Records Act authorized the creation of the Assassinations Records Research Effort. and a committee was formed to go out and identify records and release them. That released a ton more. So up from about 95 to about 2005, we got tons and tons of new documents. And matter of fact, you really didn't know the assassination until you saw those documents and saw the work of the ARB, especially some of their medical interviews, the interviews with the autopsy doctors. To give you an example, and this is kind of sad in a way, because you feel bad for this first generation of researchers who were just kind of probing around in the dark. The ARB interviewed the autopsy doctor, head autopsy doctor. And this is, I think, a good example of when skepticism reaches its maximum. They ask him very simply after a couple of hours of interview and descriptions, said, well, doctor, here are the official photos. Would you just show us on these official photos where the fatal bullet entry was? The doctor goes, no, can't do that. What do you mean? He says, well, there must have been some other photos. No, doctor, these are the only photos in evidence. You know, what would you have told the jury? You know, Lee Oswald was still alive when you did this autopsy. Did you not mark up the photos the way any criminal autopsy would? Were you not prepared to testify in court? You said there's one fatal shot from the back. Where is it? And the doctor literally, essentially laughed at him and said, sorry, can't help you. Good luck. Oof. That's the lead autopsy doctor. Now, how could you listen to that and not think you've been had?
Right. So what do you think happened? Why would he do that? Like, why didn't he mark up the documents?
Okay. Why didn't he not? The conclusion at this point is that, A, these really weren't experienced criminal autopsy doctors. Uh-huh. They didn't follow some of the protocols that should have been followed. There's just no sign in any materials that exist now that they followed some of the right protocols. And I'm not assuming that's, perhaps they didn't really understand. They were under a huge amount of pressure to come up with a quick conclusion. And I think a lot of what they did was under pressure and, you know, let's see if we can't understand this quickly. But then it's also clear that there are both photographs and x-rays that have gone missing. So the doctor may have been correct. There may have been other photographs that much more clearly showed this. Mm-hmm. But if so, why don't we have them? Mm. You know, there must be something in there that doesn't support their official story, even if it was right at the time.
And also, Kennedy's body wasn't in Dallas for very long. They shipped him out of there pretty quickly, no?
Right. Shipped him out very quickly. So I'm not saying that there's – I think you've got the factor of pressure. Now, so the autopsy was performed and essentially concluded over some 4 hours that evening. Mm-hmm. Then the doctors wrote the first autopsy report. That was destroyed. We didn't know that before. First autopsy report is destroyed. Why was it destroyed? And the autopsy notes from all three doctors disappeared.
Why?
The head doctor was asked, why, what happened? Well, I burned my notes and because they had blood on them. And, you know, that they might have been, this was dishonoring the president. It might have turned into some kind of momentum. None of this makes any sense.
No.
But we now know that there were at least two and possibly three versions of the autopsy report written before the official one went into the records. And what it seriously looks like is, you know, I talked about this 48 to 72 hour period. Mm-hmm. When a decision was made that we're going to not necessarily destroy everything. We're simply going to obfuscate. It's like a film. Only what's in front of the camera counts, right?
Right.
So as long as we make sure that nothing that overtly suggests a conspiracy goes into the official record, we're fine. And so we rewrite the report a little bit. We tweak the report. We get rid of some of the photos, some of the x-rays, and what comes out of it is nothing conclusive. It's kind of like what's in the official record does not prove a single shooter, but it doesn't prove multiple shooters either, which is accomplishes the purpose. I'll give you an example of this. I early on, I worked with Connie Kritzberg, who was a reporter in Dallas at the time of the assassination, and one of the first reporters to question the autopsy doctors afterwards, and not the autopsy doctors, the medical doctors who had treated the president. She did an interview, and she asked the doctor about the shooting. The doctor plainly showed her and pointed to her a frontal entry wound and described a frontal entry wound. And she wrote up her article for the newspaper. And she was, at the time, a single mother. She was not a frontline reporter. She hadn't had many bylines. She was really excited about the report. So by like 10 or 11 o'clock at night, she submitted a report to her editor. She goes home to her babies. And the next morning, she reads her article in the paper. And it reads differently than what she wrote. Not a lot differently, just enough differently to make it's no longer clear that there was a shot from the front. She called up her editor and said, "This is terrible. You know, that's not what I wrote. I didn't make a mistake. I report, you know, this is not right." And after arguing with her editor, which was a pretty gutsy thing to do for a young woman reporter for a while, her editor just says, "You know, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. If you want to find out why this reads like it does, you go talk to the FBI. And in later years, we managed to retrieve some other materials from the newspaper related to her article, which made it very clear that all the articles were being read over the phone to someone who was, I won't say censoring them, but I not that that is terribly suspicious. In many crimes, if you're familiar with criminology, the police don't disclose all of the details.
Right, for investigative reasons.
For investigative reasons. So I'm not even saying that that was. But one of the problems we face in this case is a lot of stuff gets in the way of solving it.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been a nice piece of information in that article, because that would have maybe right away thrown the lone gunman from the back theory out the window, right?
But it has about the same, you know, it's kind of like we have a Dallas police cop doing a video interview that afternoon saying, "Oh, well, we have people that saw Lee Oswald run out of the school book depository and jump into a car and get driven away."
Yeah.
Like, okay, that pretty well suggests a conspiracy. Well, son of a gun, within 72 hours, nobody's talking about that anymore either, even though they have half a dozen witnesses on record.
Yeah. What is, I don't know if this is a question you can answer, but is there a document out there that you think is out there that would be like the cincher? Like, what are you looking forward to seeing the most? Because from what I've been told, there's like a million more records at least that haven't been released yet. Pieces of information from all the different.
I don't think that there are any smoking gun documents about the assassination per se.
Uh-huh.
In terms of, because I've seen nothing that indicates to me that there was a real investigation. You know, that, okay, somebody did an investigation, they knew what happened, and they put it away in a file and hid it. I don't think that investigation was ever done except in one instance. We know that the CIA in Miami did investigate whether or not anti-Castro Cubans were involved. They did prepare a report. That report vanished, and then they lied about it. We know that happened.
That would be a nice report to find.
But I'm thinking that's not, you know, when I say vanished, I don't mean like filed away. I mean destroyed. But what I think we know exactly what's there that they're not going to share with us. And that relates to a series of documents that have to do with Lee Oswald and the CIA and the CIA's knowledge and use of Lee Oswald for various purposes. That has nothing to do with the assassination, but that protects, you know, the intelligence community. But it also shows that the intelligence community had every reason in the world to hide connections that might have led to an investigation. And we know, actually, Jeff Morley, there are people in D.C. who've been in court trying to obtain those, that set of documents for years now, and they've been in front of multiple federal judges. And whenever this gets in front of the judge, the CIA takes the judge behind closed chamber doors and shows him something, and he renders a verdict that it needs to be protected.
So well, do you have names in the CIA? Like, you know, we talk about all the time, the CIA did this and the CIA did that. Are there any persons of interest, you know? What are the names?
In Tipping Point, I pretty much exactly name the individuals I suspect were involved. David Morales, CIA officer, one of the key individuals. And I name the likely candidates among the their surrogates who they had been working with for some years. Now, so I can name some CIA officers. Rip Robertson, another CIA officer I definitely suspect was involved.
Rip Robertson? Okay, yeah. Morales, I've heard before. I've not heard that other name, Rick Robertson.
Yeah, I can name some people as suspects. Again, I can't prove anything at this date and time because they were never investigated during the period of time when you could make a case. It's too late to make a criminal case. All you can do is list them as persons of extreme interest. I probably mentioned, and I do not think, I think in far terms of the actual tactical attack in Dallas, you're probably talking about no more than a dozen people that were involved in different roles, 2 to 3 shooters.
Yeah,
some logistics people, some support people, some oversight, a standard paramilitary. I mean, basically, they used exactly the tactics that they had been trying to use against Fidel Castro for 2 years.
Right.
And they simply transplanted those and took them to Dallas.
Wow. Go ahead.
The interesting thing is, one of the reasons to think that is that you had mentioned the Garrison investigation earlier.
Yeah.
When the Garrison investigation, actually before the Garrison investigation became publicly known, it became known to some of these individuals because of Garrison's approaches in Miami. Basically, it was like a tripwire. He started asking questions. They realized certain things were being investigated. John Roselli, who had been involved in the Castro assassination projects with Dave Morales, among others, went to Washington, D.C., and to Warren and to the Secret Service and to the FBI and ultimately to the president and said, look, there was a conspiracy. I have proof. Would you guys like to talk to me about it? I can tell you how it worked. I can give you names. And nobody wanted to talk to him, even though he was very credible in having been involved and shown as being involved in these earlier projects. And basically what he told them was, yes, CIA team that had been sent to kill Castro was turned on Kennedy, which is very interesting. But the way he spun it was even more interesting. What he said was, yeah, that team was turned on Kennedy by Castro. So basically, he was trying to get in with, like, if there's going to be a new investigation and some information starts coming out, let's not make it look like it was any CIA guys. Let's make it look like the Cubans, okay? Could we all agree on that? Because we want them to be the bad guys.
Sure.
But if you take away that very last part, it is the same scenario. Yes, they were taken and turned on JFK.
You touched on something before, and I wrote a little note down because I think you talked about there not be really being any, there was really no way to do any sort of criminal investigation or criminal trial. So then I guess my question is why bother? Is it just an, it can't be just an, like, is it just a fun hobby? Like, why bother unveil the truth, considering the fact that it's 2020 and it's probably too late to bring anybody to justice for this?
Well, I think, okay, three answers to that. Yeah. One, literally, is history. I mean, a number of the people that are involved in this now are, if not professional historians, that's their bent. They want to document real history. And that's why I've been involved with it for some time. I mean, one of the sites I'm also, it's called History Matters. You know, we think history matters, and it's kind of an obligation to get the real history captured if you can for people that want to see it. Okay, so that's, you know, that's just one bent. I think the other thing for me personally was that it helps, this is an example that helps understand the bigger picture of how government and national security works, which my JFK work led me to write a whole series of books on national security. Shadow warfare, surprise attack, you know, how does the national security complex work under stress? How does it do covert action? How does it respond to crises? So you can, this is, you can use the data from the Kennedy assassination to help provide insights into some much broader things. So that's helpful, again, for historians. For the other people, I think, I'll be perfectly honest, a lot of the first and second generation researchers felt that they had a personal obligation. I myself and a lot of the older folks sincerely believe that it was JFK's action during the missile crisis that avoided a war which would have killed all of us. So there is a debt in play. And I'll have to say, I know that may sound soft and silly, whatever, but for a lot of folks, you know, you need to honor those kind of debts, which means you need to get the truth. Why was he really killed if it wasn't just a lone nut? So that's the third reason. And the fourth, of course, is it does become a hobby. Like all historical events become hobbies for some people, whether it's the Custer at the Little Bighorn, or, you know, whatever. It does become a hobby for some people, but
that creates
there are different levels for others of us. 30 years would make an awful lot. I have other hobbies. You know, I do have other hobbies I could be doing. And my wife keeps going, why do you have those telescopes? Oh, well, yeah, I'll use them one day. Okay, yeah.
Once I figure this out, do you think you think you one day you are going to figure out, or at least the community will finally unveil what
really I'm done for myself. Tipping point is when I got to that, to writing that final, that's my best cut. I can't see going any further. So it's not that I'm done with the subject. I'll probably speak to it, talk about it, but unless something that I can't even visualize at this point in time would come out. Yeah. I as far as the body of data that we have, I think, and I will say, and I don't think I could have written this, we have learned things only in the last 5 years from documents and oral history that we didn't know before. I wrote books on the Kennedy assassination in 2006, 2010, and 2012. And none of them got me to the end. Only now do I think I could get to the end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it seems like. It seems like as the light gets brighter as we get further away, oddly enough.
Well, one of the things that really does, it's not just because of the documents, it's because now we can read the documents. A lot of this is a huge amount of grunt work. We had documents that make sense, that made no sense to us now because we didn't know the codes. We didn't know the cryptonyms. We didn't know the aliases. We didn't know the pseudonyms. Now, after a decade or more of work, we know, and we can read it, and we know who was doing what down to the level of an individual. And we know individual histories. and assignments and who was working with who. The documents by themselves did us no good until we could. And of course, they weren't supposed to. They were protecting all this from the Russians, which works perfectly well to protect it from us, too.
Well, that's fascinating, because I always said, and when I listen to sometimes the books or I read the books, I just imagine, you know, like a CIA memo uncovered that, you know, and I just always in my mind envisioned a memo that literally said, you know, David Morales sat down and had coffee at such and such a cafe with Lee Harvey Oswald, right? But you're saying that these memos are written in code with code names and...
Oh, yeah, to understand even a routine internal memo. And one of the reasons we know this, I mean, the world operated with paper. So sometimes this gets so complex that some poor person who's working for the CIA, right? Yeah. He gets this memo and he doesn't know who these people are either.
Right.
And so he has to find out and he makes a note, a handwritten note on the paper. And we get a copy of that and we go, oh, aha, that's who this person is. You know, it's not like anybody provided you. Now, eventually over time, we got Crips for Dury's operation, but it's just a huge amount of grunt work because none of them are in clear text. They weren't, that would have been a violation of operational security. So, you know. Mm-hmm. And I will say the other thing that prevents us from ever knowing the absolute truth. You've got to understand how the intelligence community worked and the agency worked and what files they kept and what files they didn't keep and what went into central files and what you're going to see. Can you imagine the amount of work it's taken? Because there's no volunteer from the CIA telling you how this works. You know, you've got to reverse engineer all of this. And that took decades also. So I know that probably sounds confusing to you, but without a considerable degree of obsession, you're never going to get the data that you need to even start thinking about it.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. Larry Hancock, I think we're out of time. I want to thank you for talking to me and taking this time. Do you have anything else you want to add or did I miss anything?
No, I think that covers it really well. If you have any more questions future, let me know. And I hope it helped.
I'd like to stay in touch. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Take care. Have a nice evening.